It's going to be a meaty talk today, so I hope you have a pen and paper ready. We're here today to talk about mental illness, suicide, and finding God in the darkness. But I'm actually going to take a tangent right from the beginning. Can you raise your hand if you know Pastor Mark Bolander? Okay, so Pastor Mark Bolander apparently came from the church I grew up in Toronto, which is called Banfield. He was the associate pastor there. And the day I was born, there was something wrong with the pregnancy. And so they took an x-ray of my mother's womb because they didn't have ultrasounds back then, way back then. And what they found, what they saw, was that I was missing an arm and a leg. And so they drugged my mother when she was going to have me. And they brought in a bunch of people to pray over my mother's womb. And the doctors said, your child's going to be born without an arm and a leg. I was willing to pay the price to be here. But these people prayed over me, and a few hours later, they did the C-section, and I came out like this. I say it was my first practical joke. Pastor Mark Bolander was one of those people who prayed over me. So it kind of blew me away when I posted that I was speaking at Country Hills Church. My mom said, oh, Pastor Mark Bolander started that church, and he was one of the people who prayed over you. So it's quite an honor on many different levels to be here speaking with you today. I'm going to raise this a little bit because I'm short, but I'm not that short. So today I'm going to be sharing a piece of my story with you. I'll be talking about mental illness, suicide, and finding God in the darkness. I'll share with you statistics so that we can comprehend how many people these issues affect and how we can respond effectively. I speak to you today as one who's been affected by another's life, who is tattered by a mental illness called psychotic depression, but also as one who lives with a mental disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. I speak to you as a person who's been left behind by one who's died by suicide, and also as one who's faced the anguish of suicidal thoughts herself. I'm going to be starkly vulnerable with you today. I've known the greatest supports in my life to appear at times when I've remained hopeful while laying bare my soul. Being present this morning may require you to be somewhat vulnerable too, but I think that you might find that by doing so, you, like me, are anything but alone. I'm going to ask you all to stand, please. And I'm going to ask you a question. I want you to listen very carefully. If you've known someone who has died by suicide, if you or someone you know has had thoughts of suicide, or if you or someone you know has attempted suicide, please continue to stand. Everyone else can sit down. Take a moment to look around. Look at how many lives in this room have been touched by suicide, which is heartbreaking, but also hopeful because we're not alone. Thank you. You can take a seat. This first part of my story began in 2006 when I met and married my first husband, Neil. Neil had been a crack cocaine addict and had suffered with a mental illness for many years. He later entered the Teen Challenge Drug and Rehabilitation Center, where he got clean and dedicated his life to serving the Lord, and seemed to be healed of his mental illness. His favorite verse was John 8:36. Therefore, if the Son, Jesus, sets you free, you shall be free indeed. His conversion was a remarkable story. A couple years later, we met and married. After only 8 months of marriage, while living in London, Ontario, his mind started slipping again. Up until this point, Neil thought that the mental illness that he lived with was directly connected to his drug use. Since he was no longer on drugs, it didn't make sense that a mental illness should be plaguing his mind again. We then learned that mental illness can be induced by stress. So we agreed that he should leave his job, which he did, and we thought that we had avoided a messy situation, or at least that's what I thought. A few weeks later, my grandfather passed away, And the day after the funeral, I drove my sister back to Oklahoma, where she was living at the time. While I was out of the country, Neil attempted suicide. It was one of the worst episodes he had ever experienced because he was not on medication and he was in complete denial that this could be happening to him, especially in light of his new belief in Christianity. I have no desire to dispute the Bible, but I also won't pretend to be able to interpret it perfectly. I do, however, speculate, what if the freedom that Jesus was referring to was not for this life only, but perhaps for freedom in the next? I talked about being prayed over this morning, and a miracle happened over my life. And often when we pray, I think our heart's desire is that we want to see that same thing happen with whatever we're praying about. But prayers aren't always answered that way. I'm going to read you an excerpt from my book, Breathe, A True Story About Marriage, Faith, and Attempted Suicide. This book was my journals that I wrote when my first husband, Neil, had attempted suicide. And they're my thoughts about how I work through that process and how we face that trial. And this has been shared with other people with Neil's permission. I think that's really important for people to know. The portion I'm going to read to you today, it takes about 5 minutes. And it was written shortly after Neil was released from the hospital. So when he attempted suicide, he was put in a mental ward for 3.5 weeks. And then he was released. The hospital released Neil early. Incoming patients needed beds, and Neil, unlike others, had support at home. I felt I was in over my head. I questioned how our lives had become so convoluted. Deep in my heart, I felt it was no one's fault. Mental illness did not befall individuals because they had been bad or because they had done something wrong, right? By this point in my life, I had learned that good things didn't always happen to people who did the right things, just as bad things didn't always happen to people who acted badly. Events and outcomes were not always dependent on whether one was good or bad. In fact, I would argue the opposite to be true. The good-natured, the trusting, the loving, the kind were often taken advantage of in their transparent vulnerability. Those like Martin Luther King Jr., John Lennon, Jesus, and Gandhi were all activists of love, yet hate drew toward them like a bullet, shooting each one dead. Why love? Why be transparent and vulnerable if suffering ensued? Why trust? Why stand one's ground instead of running away? For that matter, why live if the uncontrollable sludge of life landed smack dab on one's lot? Then again, wasn't the world a better place because of the speeches of Martin Luther King Jr., the music of John Lennon, the passion and compassion of Jesus, and the thought-provoking legacy of Gandhi? Wasn't the world better for every brave soldier who, armed only by courage and love, fought battles of the body, mind, emotions, and soul? Why fight? I had to believe that loving determination would win. It might win after the fighter had fallen, but if it won in the end, wasn't that what mattered? Yet could I survive the cost of this battle? Facing adversity, struggling and striving to overcome, didn't that kind of fighting lend itself to helping others understand that a legacy awaited them every day they had the courage to get out of bed? Whether the hospitalized or the caregivers, it took strength, energy, and fortitude to face a new day. Every step built a path to overcoming. For Neil and I, if we were destined to live with tragedy, my hope was that it could be turned into a testimony, like the story of Job in the Bible, whose family were taken from him, along with his livestock and all he had worked so hard for. His loss was later restored. Or like Jacob, who thought his most beloved son Joseph had died, but stayed faithful and many years later was reunited with his living son. Or Peter, who had denied Jesus as the Messiah, but later willingly laid down his life as proof of his converted belief being crucified for his outspoken conviction in a Savior whose love revolutionized the world. Those testimonies reminded me, if there was not hope in the here and now, there was hope in the hereafter. Well, in the here and now, I recognized good did not mean accepted by others. Good did not mean free from trials and tribulations. Good did not mean easy, or that bad would not follow fast on its heels, trying to tear down every ounce of sweet justice good deserved. What Neil and I were faced with was nothing that could be undone. It was something we had to wrestle through. As I struggled with my own dark thoughts, I fought to win the battle by reminding myself that life had a pattern of getting better, even when it seemed in the crippling darkness there was no way out. I focused on times when I had felt hopeless, when I would fall on my knees and weep, crying out in desperation to be saved from my deep pain, my all-consuming sorrow. As I had been in that state more than once, I learned that although the night might blot out the light, the sun still rose in the morning. There were times I had fallen apart, and yet life had proved to be worth living again, but only because I held on for a new day. So I fought to hold on through the darkness we were in with the hope that the light would one day return. After Neil's suicide attempt, life changed dramatically for us both. For Neil, he had to learn to trust me as best as he could. When his mind would start slipping into what I call a mental episode, he became paranoid and fearful of everyone. It was terrifying for him to think of putting his safety in someone else's hands by being vulnerable with me, by telling me when he needed help. But he learned, and I learned to hope for the best, even though I knew the worst could one day happen. The worst in my mind at that time was that he would die by suicide. And then, on March 8th, 2011, he did. You may have some kind of image in your mind as to who is affected by mental illness or thoughts of suicide. I want to tell you more about my late husband, who he was, what he accomplished, and what kind of heart he had to help you understand that mental illness in those who struggle with suicide does not have just any face. It can look like anyone because it does not discriminate. Neil was incredibly successful. He worked in sales for a multi-million-dollar company, and he won every sales contest in his division, and I mean every single one. In fact, even after a 2.5-month leave of absence, he still brought in more new business than his colleague who was hired before him. Neil was part of the Elevation Church community in Waterloo for a number of years. He was on the life committee there, was part of a small group, and we planted our family roots in that community. Neil picked up hitchhikers, which I'm not promoting, but just saying he had a real heart for those in need. And while living in London, Ontario for a year, he helped a homeless couple get off the streets. They now have their own apartment and are employed. Neil also suffered tremendous losses. He was severed from having a relationship with a prominent member of his family. His sister died at the young age of 29. She was his only sibling. And he lived with the dreaded reality that his mind could sabotage him at any moment. Every time it did, he lost security and hope that he could survive another round. Until Neil's death, I suspect that most people who knew him would have had no idea how severe the mental illness was that he lived with. I was married to him, and I didn't even understand how severe it was. Remember that. One of the reasons why I share so openly about our story is because this illness has any face. It can look like you or me. According to Health Canada, 1 in 5 Canadians will experience a mental illness in their lifetime. I suspect that number is actually probably quite a bit higher. The remaining 4 will have a friend, family member, or colleague who will. In the U.S., the numbers are reported to be 1 in 4. We must learn to talk about these issues if we're going to be there for the 100% of the population who is affected. The Canadian Association for Suicide Prevention states 1 in 7 Canadians has seriously thought about suicide, thought about dying by suicide. That's 14% of the people sitting in this room. Mental disorders and thoughts of suicide affect people both inside and outside the church, both within Canada and globally. In fact, Canada houses the suicide capital of the world. A small reserve in northern Ontario called Pakangikam has the highest rate of suicide per capita in the world. According to the World Health Organization, one person dies by suicide globally every 40 seconds. And this is not just a young person's issue, as many people suspect, because a lot of attention gets driven towards that particular demographic. But according to a study done by Statistics Canada, men 65 years of age and older have the highest suicide rate in Canada. Men 90 years of age and older have the highest rate globally. So where do we as the church fit into all of this? What can we do to be there for the people like myself and others who are faced with these realities? First, let's have a look at what the Bible says. I'm going to start with the story of Judas in the New Testament, and then we'll have a look at Saul's death in the Old. If you'd like, you can turn with me to Matthew 27, verses 1 to 8. The context of this reading is that Judas has already struck a deal to betray Jesus, accepted his payment, and handed Jesus over to the Romans. When morning came, all the chief priests and elders of the people plotted against Jesus to put him to death, and when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate, the governor. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he, Jesus, had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "I sinned by betraying innocent blood." Imagine how that must have felt. Ever regret anything and wish you could undo it? And they said, "What is that to us? You see to it." Then he threw down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. But the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the treasury because they are the price of blood," meaning Jesus' blood. And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. That's it. There's no judgment laid. There's no proclamation that Judas is going to hell. There's no quarreling about where he should be buried or speculation about why this has happened. We know he felt remorse. Just imagine what that must have felt like. And there's no indication that he lived with a mental illness. Keep that in mind, because not everyone who dies by suicide lives with a mental illness, and not everyone who lives with a mental illness is going to die by suicide. Now let's explore the suicide of Saul and King David's reaction to both Saul and Jonathan's deaths. You can follow along in 1 Samuel 31, verses 1 to 6, or up on the screen. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore, Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. A chapter later, King David is lamenting over both Saul, who died by suicide, and Jonathan, who was killed by the Philistines. He makes no differentiation between how these two men died. He honors them both and declares the song he wrote for them should be taught to all the children of Judah, and this has become my life's mandate. Here is an excerpt from the Song of the Bow by David, found in 2 Samuel 1, verse 23. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were faster than lions. I find that first line fascinating. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. It seems to me that suicide, according to the Bible, was accepted as one of the ways people died. That's it. I am not making light of this topic, and believe me, I continue to live with the effects that suicide has had on my life. But I also think it's important to understand how the people in the Bible viewed it and the history of how our culture's thinking towards suicide developed. There was a historical shift in the Middle Ages that very much continues to influence the way we perceive death by suicide today. In George Minois' History of Suicide, he explains that it was St. Augustine who condemned suicide, basically because there were Christians who were literally dying to get into heaven. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd want to be alive in the Middle Ages. Pretty horrible times to be alive. But what do you do about that when you are losing so many members of your church? In AD 563, the Council of Braga made this condemnation official. Declaring suicide a crime also allowed the powers in the Middle Ages to take advantage of these deaths. It enabled them to justify confiscating a person's property instead of it being handed over to the family. It also gave them the power to grant the right to die by suicide if, for example, in Rome, an individual could soundly justify why they wanted to end their life, in which case, if the Senate agreed, they would actually provide the hemlock free of charge. But they also had power to refuse those whose deaths would create an economic burden, such as a soldier, a slave, or those accused of a capital crime. So now that we understand how many people are affected by suicide, what the Bible says about suicide, and the history behind our cultural thinking today, let's talk about what's helpful and what's harmful. One of the first and easiest things we can do to bring about positive change is by adjusting our language. Suicide is not a crime, nor should families be made to feel that it is. Guilt, isolation, and condemnation are destructive. They only worsen the mental state of those trying to survive and those left behind. The term committed suicide does just that. Suicide prevention councils are now urging people to use he died by, she died by, or suicided. Our language determines perception, so it's really important that we say what we mean. The Canadian Association for Suicide Prevention reveals family members bereaved by suicide are 8 times more likely to die by suicide themselves. Those bereaved by suicide are often dealing with a strong sense of guilt, trauma, grief, and depression. We need your care and compassion. We need your love and understanding. We need to know that you'll be there for us, accepting us as we are, and be gracious to the memory of the one we lost, because that person, no matter how complicated the circumstances, was also the one we loved. Loretta Archibald wrote a poem called A Suicide Survivor's Beatitudes. The following excerpts from that piece best describe the gift my community gave me. Blessed are those who give us permission to mourn the loss of one dearly loved, free of judgment, censure, and shame. Blessed are spiritual guides who relieve our concerns for the repose of our loved one's soul with the truth that God is all-knowing, all-loving, and all-forgiving. Blessed are the mental health care providers who explain to us that very probably our loved one died of a terminal illness called depression. Blessed are those that allow and encourage us to use our loved one's death in a manner that gives our loss and grief meaning and purpose. In my church community, I have certainly been blessed. The number one reaction that has been healing for me is talking to people who don't feel they need to have the answers, but who are simply willing to listen and learn. I have taken for granted the luxury of how loving my community has been to journey with. I can say with confidence that I'm able to do the suicide prevention work I do today because they had the attitude with me that they wanted to meet me where I was at, journey with me. I didn't have to have it figured out. They didn't have to have it figured out. But maybe someone along the way might figure something out. And I think we have. It was not until I started to get to know other people's stories that I was saddened to learn that the church is often the last place people who are having thoughts of suicide or struggling with a mental illness think to turn to. Unfortunately, the church at large has a reputation for criticizing, over-spiritualizing, and condemning. These are attitudes that not only harm those living with a mental illness and deter them from seeking treatment, but also damages the relationship between the church and those who love and want to protect those individuals. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention states 90% of people who die by suicide have a diagnosable and treatable psychiatric disorder at the time of their death. This is tragic, but also cause for hope because we can change these statistics. And you already are. Here's why. The World Health Organization says stigma about mental disorders and discrimination against patients and families prevent people from seeking mental health. When people judge, when they don't take time to properly understand, they are part of the detrimental setback that stigmas cause. But by having this conversation here today, you are already doing much to destigmatize mental illness both inside and outside the church, and becoming the lived-out love I believe Jesus intended us to be. In the general church community, there are varying schools of thought on mental illness that contribute to the stigma. I asked some friends of mine who live with mental illness what responses Christians have given them that are not only potentially harmful because they may be untrue, but have turned them off the church. One, your mental illness is caused by a lack of faith or an inadequate prayer life. Two, Satan has a foothold on your life. Three, have more faith and it'll get better. Four, if you take pills, that means you don't have enough faith. These types of responses can be incredibly harmful. The worst mental episode Neil experienced, other than the one that took his life, was after he became a Christian, while he was not on medication. But I also understand this way of thinking, even though I no longer agree with it. When I was married to Neil, I compartmentalized the decisions he made into two categories. I thought he was either in a mental episode and couldn't make very good decisions, or he was not in a mental episode and, in my opinion, I thought perhaps sometimes he should be making better ones, not just mental at all. While he was living, my world was segmented into black and white, option A, option B. After Neil died, when I was able to breathe a little more from the trauma that we were living in, when I was able to step back and see more of the picture that we were living in, I realized that many factors affect someone's ability to make decisions. For example, how we were nurtured as a child and whether or not certain connectors in our brain develop properly. The food we eat, whether or not we're deficient in certain nutrients and the chemicals we're exposed to. Neil had a mouthful of amalgam fillings that were turning black and likely leaking mercury into his body. Heavy metals like mercury accumulate in the fat cells of the body. Guess what? There are fat cells in the brain. There was the question of how his addictions had altered his mind, but also whether he started taking drugs because he had felt the onset of mental illness, or was the mental illness as a result of his drug use. Genetics can be a factor. How about environmental toxins? In my previous house, where I lived a couple years ago, I had a mold inspection company come and do samples in every room of my house. And even though I would not have known on my own that there was mold in my house, they found that there were toxic mold in my bedroom and high levels of allergenic mold throughout the rest of the house. Both can affect our moods and mental health. I know a girl who struggled with suicidal thoughts for a long time. Doctors finally discovered she had a rare liver condition, a side effect of which was suicidal ideation. Rehabilitation centers are starting to appear around the globe for addictions, but they're not for addictions to drug and alcohol. They're for individuals who are addicted to technology and devices. Once thought of as efficient tools and connecting resources are now being found to rewire the brain, cause social anxiety and self-destructive behavior, including suicide. As someone who now lives with post-traumatic stress disorder, my response to situations that trigger that trauma is to look for the off switch. Control, Alt, Delete. My emotions spin out of control like a car crash before I've even realized that I've been sideswiped. And there are those who have a brain injury from being in a physical accident. My point is, looking back, I have to ask myself, how on earth did I ever think I could solve the mystery of my husband's mental illness based on two factors? And of course, there is the question of one's spiritual health and how that contributes to the health of one's mind. Unfortunately, some Christians have taken the spiritual component and overshadowed other important possibilities with it, or left spirituality as a feeling, as only a feeling, forgetting that being spiritual is as much about using the intelligence that God gave us to solve life's riddles as it is about having an emotional experience. Now that we've talked about what are helpful and harmful responses, I want to revisit history, only this time we're going to look at it from a medical perspective. In the 5th century BC, there was a famous Greek physician who's now known as the father of medicine. Anyone know his name? Hippocrates. The Hippocratic Oath of Professional Conduct is still acknowledged by our doctors today. What made Hippocrates so important is that he pronounced that diseases were natural events. This took tremendous courage because people in his day and culture, imagine the Greek culture, Greek mythology, they believed that illness was punishment from the gods or a form of primitive magic. Sound familiar? Thanks to him, we began to look at diseases differently. We made new discoveries and explored new techniques. After Hippocrates, James Simpson introduced chloroform. I'm really glad that he did that. And Joseph Lister brought in the use of antiseptics. In fact, up until Lister's time, it seems a connection between surgeons not washing their hands and wearing clean clothes in the operating room and patients getting infections and gangrene hadn't been made. Imagine. Sometimes in the mental health world, some answers will be this obvious once we remove the barrier of stigma. Others will be much more complex. Mental illness can seem elusive, like emotions. We need to remember that the mind is part of the brain, and the brain is an organ in our bodies, just like the heart, kidneys, liver, and so on. We need to continue to make breakthroughs. We're just on the cusp of understanding the vast complexities of the brain organ. And of course, we need to use the good sense that God gave us to maintain and restore our mental health. Just like we would with any other organ in our body, we need to feed it well, treat it well by not abusing it with an excess of stress, medicate it sometimes so the chemicals in our brain are balanced if they're unable to do so on their own, as we would with heart and diabetic medication. For example, maybe we even need to repair the brain through operations when necessary, and yes, we also need to strive for a healthy spiritual lifestyle. But like Hippocrates, acknowledge that not all mental illness is punishment from the gods. We have an opportunity to drive forward the future of mental health by acknowledging the physical, environmental, and spiritual factors that contribute to an individual's mental state. We also have hope in our faith that can set us apart and truly make the church a place of refuge. I encourage those faced with the present darkness, dying for new medical breakthroughs and compassion from community, to consider this word from Exodus 20, verses 18 to 21. The context here is that Moses has brought the Israelites out of Egypt where they were slaves, and now they're wandering in the desert, which can sometimes feel like our time on this earth. Anyone relate to that? This wandering time, however, is packed full of rich lessons they glean before they enter the promised land. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. Then they said to Moses, "You speak with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Because God is light, I thought that was only where he could be found. For example, if there was a storm, I thought about how the sun still shone above the clouds of darkness, and that's where hope was. Then I read this, and I realized God is in the darkness too. I'm often trying to get beyond certain stages to reach a brighter point, but there is something valuable, some unique connection that is made with God in the darkness. There is an opportunity to meet with him there. Moses was one of the few who got to meet with God in the darkness. It was not for everyone. It was for a courageous few. I'm going to invite the worship team to come up while I close. Emil Haskins writes, "I said to the man at the gate of the year, 'Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown.' And he replied, 'Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way.'" As we head into the coming weeks, may we welcome those living with a mental illness and struggling with thoughts of suicide to teach us. May we remember that God gave us intelligence to break new ground and compassion to journey with others, even though we might not yet have the answers. Above all, may we remember that God is present and can even be found in the darkness.